Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. For today's episode, I'm speaking with the author and journalist Sarah Scholes about her new book, Countdown, The Blinding Future of Nuclear Weapons. This conversation is really interesting because unlike a lot of conversations around nukes, this isn't just about relitigating the past, though we obviously get into that. It's about the future, what modernization looks like, and how we could think about the state of the United States' nuclear arsenal in the face of potential or future conflicts in Europe, Asia, and across the globe. Hope you all enjoy the conversation. I'm looking forward to having more conversations like this one, integrating the technical questions with the deeply important geopolitical ones. Huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for the work of this podcast. Hope you enjoy the conversation. Sarah Scholes, welcome to The Realignment.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
First, an obvious question you're hearing from, I'm sure, everybody. What's it like to write a book on the future of nuclear weapons, the year of Oppenheimer?
Well, fortunately for me, or unfortunately, I didn't know that it would be the year of Oppenheimer when I pitched the book. But I mean, I think it's part of my goal in writing the book was just to bring nuclear issues kind of more in public, because they're usually just, you know, they're think tank topics or Defense Department topics. And I wanted them to become more public topics. And, you know, a big blockbuster movie is one way to do that also. So me and Christopher Nolan, I think, are on the same page.
Yeah, good page to be on. When did you pitch the book then? Because I think the timeline there is really interesting.
Yeah, it was back in 2020, late 2020 was when I pitched it. And I had been reporting for a while on the national labs, which are these labs kind of spread across the country where scientists work on maintaining the nuclear arsenal, and kind of, you know, became aware of a big modernization program that I'm sure we'll talk about some. And I thought, hey, it seems like these weapons are about to come more to the forefront, and maybe I should kind of get on the ground floor of trying to figure out what's up with all of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm taking myself back to 2020. And I think probably if we were having that conversation then, the concerns and focus on nuclear weapons would probably center around the Iran deal, Donald Trump's on and on, off again relationship with Kim Jong-un. Now, of course, though, we're not only focusing on North Korea and the, you know, Iran deal, we're also focusing on Russia, Ukraine, United States and China. So it's interesting how there's just this really compressed 6-7-8 year period where all of this is just not just like academic, but deeply, deeply a thing here.
Right. And yeah, kind of like you said, one thing after another of just like constantly changing. And that was honestly, I mean, that was something that interested me about doing the reporting, is that, you know, during the Cold War, it was largely just like a one-on-one cold confrontation. And now there's just so many more dynamics with so many more countries involved and doing scary things all the time. So,
yeah. And you kind of have this line at the start of the book, which I think is kind of really important to think about here. I'd love for you to talk about the millennial generational relationship with nuclear weapons, because as you put it, you know, you didn't grow up, we're from the same generational cohort. Like, we didn't grow up with air raid shelters. I saw the day after the special, like on TV in like the early 2000s, people should watch it. Super scary. Very, it was basically back when like basic television could produce something of like hardcore HBO quality, but I watched it like upon reflection. The Soviet Union didn't exist like when we were in elementary school, different things like that. So I think it's meant that this moment that we just described, this past decade where nuclear weapons are back at the forefront, has been a bit of a vibe shift. Like, I'd love you to kind of talk about that kind of from your experience, but just also the broader generational point too.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that people from the previous generation, you know, they did take part in air raid drills, and the Cold War was, you know, it was something that was happening when they were, you know, conscious beings aware of what was going on in the world. And we were kind of born into a world where that was fading into the background and then was over and had faded into the background. And I think, you know, not just us, but world leaders and the people in charge of nuclear weapons kind of also thought, you know, these particular weapons are probably going to take a back seat, and we can kind of move away from them as this constant threat in the background. And, you know, that has turned out not really to be the case. But I think for, you know, the years immediately after that, that was the way we grew up. And, you know, people continued to work on them. The scientists who are involved with them continued to maintain them. And they did continue to play a role in world politics, but just as this kind of like constant low level hum in the background. And so I think, yeah, really until the past few years, we've kind of had the privilege of letting them think about it and us not think about it. It's been kind of a rude awakening probably for the millennial generation.
Yeah. And just because I was just always thinking about the way you framed it, because during the start of the war in Ukraine, I work in think tank world, so this is just my actual area of specialty. A friend of mine called me in tears. This isn't someone who focused on politics or policy very deeply, but they just were waking up. There was all the talk about could a nuclear weapon be used? And they were just like actually asking in tears, seriously, like, do you think the world is going to end? And obviously, like, upon reflection at the time, I was like, no, this is war in Ukraine obviously isn't fine, but like clearly there's a process. This isn't going to escalate. The Biden administration is very well aware of the dynamics, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think so much of that emotional reaction that I think a lot of people had was just like this specter from the past just coming back right into the present, which I think what makes works like yours so helpful. So this is a good thing to take us to. You made reference to like nuclear modernization and the work that like scientists and researchers are doing. What's that in reference to?
Yeah, so right now the nuclear arsenal that we have is largely a relic of the Cold War. Like most of the weapons, all of the designs, and a lot of the components are all decades old, in part because we did enter this post-Cold War era where it seemed like they might have a reduced importance. But, you know, they are machines like any other machines, and they are machines that are also radioactive. And so, you know, you can't just leave them on a shelf and do nothing to them. And so right now, we are in the process of modernizing them, which involves looking for problems that may have arisen since they were built, fixing those, adding some new parts and sensors. The reason I'm being vague is because we don't actually have a ton of public details about, you know, the very specifics of what that means. But the biggest part of nuclear modernization at the moment, in my opinion at least, is something called plutonium pit production. Definitely rolled off my tongue. In the middle of most modern nuclear weapons is this kind of hollow sphere made of a plutonium alloy. And it's surrounded by just regular explosives, not radioactive explosives. And what sets off a nuclear weapon is setting off those explosives, kind of squishing this plutonium together to create really intense pressures and temperatures, and then starting a fission reaction. And so those plutonium pits are all, 40 or so years old or older. And we've decided that, you know, that's not a good thing and we should replace them, but we haven't really built them since 1989. And so kind of getting our infrastructure back in gear to be building those for the first time in a very long time.
Obviously, all nuclear, well, the major nuclear powers, the United States and Russia specifically, have clearly reduced their nuclear stockpiles since the end of the Cold War, various treaties like START 1, START 2. If we're thinking about this modernization process, is there any discussion about, hey, like, is this an opportunity just to maybe like reduce the overall stockpile through attrition, rather than just sort of like remodernizing different things like that? Like, how does that play into this?
Yes, it could present that kind of an opportunity in the circles of the people who make those kinds of decisions. It's not something I've heard talked about as something that will happen. I mean, I think in part because, you know, relations with Russia have degraded, to say the least, in recent years. And I think we probably don't have confidence that that is something that they are interested in doing. And if they're not going to do it, we probably are not going to do it either. But you know, on an individual level, there are philosophical and strategic proposals in that direction. There's an idea called minimal or minimum deterrence, which is the idea that we should all have, you know, the least number of nuclear weapons possible to just, you know, deter someone else's attack. And then there's also the idea of capability-based deterrence, which is just, you could do away with all or most of your nuclear weapons. And as long as you can demonstrate to other people that, like, you could build one really quick if you really wanted to, and retaliate. And so there are proposals on the table, but I think I've not seen anything that, you know, seems to be making its way into the real world beyond the world of ideas.
Yeah. And I think when you phrase it that way, it's interesting because if we look at previous post-Cold War nuclear stockpile reductions, they've been very tit for tat in terms of like treaties and things like START. So it's not, if there's room, at least the way we've approached this policy for the past several decades, if there's room to reduce US stockpiles, you'd want to also use that as leverage to say, hey, like, we're going to knock out 500, you knock out X number as well too. That's been the way this has traditionally operated. You're not really seeing like unilateral reductions. I think what's so interesting about everything you're describing here, and you're a science journalist, so you're actually the person to ask here. This is especially present in Oppenheimer, the movie, and obviously the book that it's built around by Kai Bird, who gave a very generous blurb of your book, of course. So that's a huge congrats. Okay. But the quick question is, what do you see as the line between the science and the actual policy and military strategic decisions need to be basically made here?
Yeah, I mean, I think starting in the Manhattan Project with Oppenheimer and the other scientists he was working with, you know, I think a lot of them just started with the idea, you know, we are the people who have the scientific capability and expertise to accomplish this for the country so that we can accomplish it before our enemies do, so that we can be the first people in possession of a technology like this. And then as they started to work on it, like the movie shows, and have more time to think about the implications, they did and started to try to influence the policy about how they would be used. Like, there were proposals, you know, we should demonstrate this in the desert before we drop it on any people, so that those people can see, like, this is what we can do to you, and then maybe we won't have to do it to them. And, you know, that's not how it went down. And I think that was maybe one of the first realizations that scientists had, like, you can build a technological device with any intent that you want, but ultimately you're not the one who makes that decision about how it is used. And I talked to a historian named Audra Wolf, who has said that in the years since then, nuclear scientists and nuclear weapon scientists have become, you know, a field where people think more about the consequences and implications and, you know, what moral duty they have based on what they work on, but they still haven't necessarily ingested fully the idea that whatever they think about that, they might not have any control over what happens with it afterwards. And so, yeah, I think for the scientists, that's a decision they each have to make individually. Like, if I can't control the outcome of the science that I'm working on, is it something that I do want to be working on?
Yeah. And I guess I'll just ask you the direct question, like, what is your opinion on the U.S. decision to use nuclear weapons in Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
You know, no one's ever asked me that question before.
It's kind of the question. It's kind of it's awkward. I felt awkward asking because it's kind of the question.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I think that nuclear weapons, we could debate what role they play in the world, but they're obviously a terrible weapon. Civilians dying, anyone dying is a terrible thing. And I think no one ever would put me in charge of a decision like this. But I think that the idea that some of the scientists have of demonstrating somewhere without a population where no one will be harmed, like, this is what we have. Do you want to change your decisions based on what you can see that this weapon can do? That seems a more humane way of going about things. And you know what I learned in school, I don't know what you learned in school, is that the US decided to drop those two nuclear weapons because they determined that it would hasten the end of World War II enough that fewer people would die because of the bombs than would die if the war continued, particularly, you know, U.S. People. And I think historians have sort of shown since then that that wasn't actually the primary reason that World War II did end soon after that. It was a confluence of other reasons, and that's a little bit of a rewriting of history. So, I mean, I think without that justification, it's kind of a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah,
I'm curious what you think, though.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm once again, like, I spent a particular amount of my academic time, like, focused on, like, post-World War II history. And the more and more I learn about the various could have possibly happened scenarios of nuclear weapons. So, for example, Douglas MacArthur, the Chinese crossed the Yellow River during the Korean War, and he's just sort of like invoking like the specter of nuclear weapons. Dien Bien Phu, 1954, the French are asking Eisenhower to give nuclear weapons in order to actually, you know, defeat the North Vietnamese, or the Viet Minh in that case. Then obviously you have the various like potential nuclear incidents, like 1961 of Berlin, and then, you know, of course, then the Cuba Missile Crisis. I think it's ultimately a good thing that nuclear weapons were used to make clear to everybody that this is just not another form of weaponry. Because, for example, as you know, no doubt know, part of what makes the debate around nuclear weapons use in Japan is, well, look, the firebombings actually killed way more people than the nuclear weapons did.
Right.
You had firebombings of Japan, you had firebombings of Germany. And just obviously, we don't engage in the style of warfare that would necessitate the use of like napalm quite that way. But I think clearly we as a human race have determined that nuclear weapons are just in a higher category because of their destructive potential than other forms of weaponry. And that reality and that awareness has been what prevents a MacArthur from using nuclear weapons against the Chinese, is what prevents Eisenhower from giving nuclear weapons to the French in 1954. It's what helps tamp down those Cold War's 1960s crises. So I guess it was always difficult for me. And once again, this is like a post-op determination. Like, what I'm describing is definitely not what I think policymakers in the 45 were thinking, but it just seems to me so hard to imagine us avoiding the trajectory of other weapon systems of consistent usage if there was just not this clear illustration of how horrible and category changing this was. So it's not like a helpful answer, but it's just sort of the way that maybe I like reconcile how awful it feels maybe.
Yeah. And I mean, that is kind of the whole logic of why we have kept them around, even though we've all in general as a species decided these are not things we should use, we should avoid using them at all costs, is the demonstration that they are so bad. They are in this other category. And, you know, if you talk to the nuclear weapons scientists, I think maybe during everybody's like employee orientation, they all see a plot showing the number of deaths per capita in wars up to and after World War II. And there's just like a huge drop off after World War II, you know, because large scale conflict has not occurred in the same way. And we have regional conflicts and smaller wars, obviously, and things like that. But nothing has escalated since we use nuclear weapons up to the level that we had before that. And I think, you know, I'm sure that's not just due to one thing. That's not just due to the existence of nuclear weapons, but I mean, I think it's a contributing and, you know, kind of, I don't know if uncomfortable is the word, but it's a factor. And, you know, it's a hard thing for there's a lot of anti-nuclear weapon sentiment in the world, and that's fair, but you do have to account for this deterrent effect that they do seem to have.
Yeah, and it's sort of, it's interesting because in many ways you think of, I've got a book over there somewhere that, you know, talks about how World War One was seen as just so horrible, but it was supposed to be the war to end all wars. But then obviously very quickly, despite all the arms limitation treaties you had during the 20s, you get back on the track again, and then it's 19, you know, the Japanese invade Manchuria in 1931, and then very quickly you're back on the path of World War II. So I think it's just I think it's just like very depressing if you like think about this like from a realist perspective, that just having this in the background may just be this like necessary reality. I think the big question that comes from that as well too is that it's easy to show the graph of human deaths declining. It's easy for me to talk about, well, now we've seen that nuclear weapons are just so bad, never use them again. It's easy to say that when you just ignore the fact that in these Cold War incidents that I described, not just like the accidental ones, like where, you know, the Russian, the Soviet, you know, person in 1983, the system detected that there were American nuclear missiles incoming, and then he decided the system must have been incorrect, even though his actual orders were to relaunch. So we could say, oh, it all worked out great, but there are just so many. It seems as if like we consistently just rolled the die. Now that we're entering into a new period of great power conflict where there's been much more nuclear nonproliferation, what is your optimism, pessimism, or experts you've spoken to around the sustainability of maybe the die rolling on the right number as it had for the last 60, 70 years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think experts are a little more nervous about that rolling than they used to be, because, like you said, any one of those previous incidents or something in the future, all it takes is one conflict that escalates into nuclear use, or even a nuclear accident or miscommunication. All it takes is one to completely undo the ideas that we've built, you know, the past 70 or 80 years on. And if you take that chance so many times, like maybe, you know, there's another false alarm and someone makes a different decision than the Stanislav Petrov, I think the guy you were mentioning, did. And
I'm not gonna be rude in like Wikipedia mid podcast, but I was searching for something. So thank you for picking, thank you for being a partner and picking up my my track there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, people on both sides of the line, like I spoke to some people who work at organizations like Global Zero, which the is a nuclear, you know, complete abolition organization, and then also people who work on nuclear weapons at the labs, and they all agree, you know, like, yeah, we don't know for sure that it will hold forever. And I think, you know, recent events, particularly Russia's invasion of Ukraine, have made people more on edge than they used to be about the possibility. I mean, I think the odds are still in our favor for now, but it's a scary possibility to have on the table for sure.
Here's a Russia-Ukraine question I've been fascinated with ever since I came to understand this history. So key to what I think made folks so concerned about Russia's willingness to use a nuclear weapon in or around Ukraine was the awareness that, like, at a doctrinal level, the Russians don't quite conceive of nuclear weapons in the same way as we in the West and much of the like developed like nuclear world do, in the sense that to certain degrees, like they conceive of tactical nuclear weapons as being similar to like big artillery. And like during the Cold War, like we had nuclear delivery devices that were like artillery. You could deliver it through artillery. You had like man port, like there's all sorts of different permutations. I'm curious, reading this history, speaking to everyone, how do you conceive of a nuclear weapon? Everything from the most tactical, you know, dropped by a fighter bomber in Crimea, to an ICBM that's in a, you know, sub in the North Atlantic. Like, how do you conceive of them as a whole?
For the benefit of humanity, it's kind of best to conceive of them all the same way. Whether they are smaller tactical or like, you know, the suitcase nukes or backpack nukes or those kinds of things that we used to have and don't really anymore. Just to think of them like a nuclear weapon is a nuclear weapon, and let's not use it even if it wouldn't kill that many people. There's this idea called the nuclear taboo, which is exactly what it sounds like.
Yeah.
Like you were saying earlier, like just, we've all decided it's a different kind of thing than a big bomb, than a big conventional bomb. And I think as soon as you use even a smaller tactical nuclear weapon, that kind of breaks the nuclear taboo. And I think the nuclear taboo is working in our favor at the moment, because once you use a smaller one, you know, the step, if the taboo is broken, to using a bigger one, I think is smaller than if you're starting from zero. But I mean, you're right. Probably, you know, not everyone in our own government thinks of it that way, I would imagine. And, you know, not people in different countries, leaders of other countries think of things differently. And I think part of what makes nuclear strategy difficult is trying to infer how other world leaders do make those kinds of decisions. Like what do they believe to be in their interest in their cost benefit analysis and things like that. And that we can guess, but we don't actually have direct insight into it.
Another interesting, but also pretty morose phenomenon of late has just been the kind of perception that nuclear nonproliferation efforts have just collapsed. Not that there aren't, the NPT still exists, obviously. There's still, it's not open season. It's also not easy, but I think at a broader level, the point is everyone, I think, imagines a world where Iran secures a nuclear weapon for whatever reason, separate from like the Iran deal debate. And then quickly the Saudis and other Gulf rivals of Iran get nuclear weapons. You could see a world where South Korea, Japan see a threat of Asian conflict, providing the defensive reason to get those in the first place. What is your perception, and just the people you spoke to, their optimism, pessimism, up or down, on whether or not that status quo is going to continue or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the people I spoke to do work in that world, in the global security and non-proliferation parts of, like, even, you know, the national labs that work on maintaining the weapons also separately have divisions dedicated to making sure other people don't have them, and that the world doesn't get more of them. And I think, you know, there's a lot of effort still going into that. So like on the ground level, I don't think it has collapsed. And I actually think that part of the rationale for this big modernization program, which I don't think I said before, is, you know, going to cost somewhere between $1 and $2 trillion for the US. Part of the rationale is convincing other countries, not Iran, but countries kind of that are our allies and under our umbrella, that like, you can still count on us to be your new, like, you don't need nuclear weapons because you're our ally and we have them. And so I think making ours more capable and up to the current moment, part of the idea is that in kind of a convoluted way is part of non-proliferation. But I mean, I think people are definitely worried about the countries that don't fall under that that category, wanting their own for, you know, understandable reasons, even if they're reasons that we as a country don't agree with. Like, yeah.
Yeah, 100%. So in this last section, a couple quick questions. So we'll do one at a time, but the first question would basically be, what are, looking at the community of folks in the nuclear industry in the United States, what are kind of some of the like debates or open questions that are maybe open right now that the public isn't thinking about? So obviously you laid out the modernization issue. That's not really a debate. That's something that's happening. Like, are there any like debates or dynamics that we just should think about that just aren't apparent outside of the community and also are not quite classified either, to your point at the start of the episode?
Yeah. Well, luckily for all of us, I don't know about the classified ones, so I can't talk about those either way. But I mean, I think one of the debates that's kind of slightly under the surface is related to the modernization program. But, you know, if you are taking these older weapons, updating them, and then also, you know, we're making one fully new weapon, but we have agreed through the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty not to test nuclear weapons, not to detonate them and see if they work, can you rebuild weapons and can you build new weapons without testing them? And I think, you know, within the spheres of people who do work on them, the answer is like, yes, we have the confidence in our science and our, you know, software and simulation design that we can do this without ever testing it. But outside, analysts don't always agree with that. And so I think that the specter of possibly having to test something that we build to be sure that it works and is safe and reliable is something like the idea that we would go back to testing nuclear weapons seems pretty out there, but I think it's not quite as out there or quite as remote a possibility as we probably think of it.
That's fascinating. So what is being, as a layman here, what's being tested, right? Because like we know when you we know the physics, we know the process. I mean, obviously, no doubt they're testing these like firing mechanisms. What do you mean by like testing in terms of seeing what works and what doesn't work?
Yeah, so the testing we don't do is just like a full scale. We put all these, you know, firing mechanisms. We put the radioactive material. We put the explosives. We put it all together and we blow it up just like we would if we were actually dropping it and see. I mean, I don't think anyone doubts that it would, you know, blow up because, like you said, it's technology essentially, you know, that we've had for decades and decades, and we have the physics and things down. But I think what the weapon scientists always say is they need to be safe, secure, and reliable. So like they will behave the same way and the way we expect every time that we use them. And so I think just if you've never tested something at all, I think that for some people can remain a question. You know, We do have the basic physics down, but when you get into the details of what's going on within a nuclear weapon and all of its parts and pieces and all of the particles and atoms, you know, that's a lot of stuff, and we can't actually simulate it perfectly. And so there are things that we don't understand, even if we do understand the basics.
Fascinating. So I think the last Nuke question, or before we close on a question about like what you're working on now and next, we should always be hustling, obviously, is what further innovation do folks in the field see there to be done? So obviously from the 40s onwards, a lot of the innovation is about yield, right? So you're going from Hiroshima and Nagasaki to obviously you have the Tsar Bomba and you have like the hydrogen bomb. You always do like different categories. Very quickly, aside from just the fact that we have all sorts of treaties leading from the 60s, 70s, 80s about those types of tests. And it's also, I think, becomes pretty clear that at a certain point, like you don't need to build a bigger bomb, and kind of the measuring contest is like used, it's been as useful as it could have been. Is there any, I was just struggling to think of like, obviously, you know, bullets went through all sorts of like technological innovation basically every single year. And it'd be weird to imagine that we haven't found a better nuclear weapon since maybe the 70s. Like, is there anything to that dynamic at all?
Yeah. I mean, I don't, it's one of those things where they don't give me too many of the details really when I interview them, but I think, you know, there's been some public reporting about innovations in, targeting, in the ability to very precisely hit a very precise spot, on Earth is different than it was in, 1945. And I think to control exactly when a weapon would detonate, when it would go off, and my understanding is that is for hardened targets, like somebody in a bunker underground. Mm-hmm. Like you don't want it if it goes off too high up. That doesn't do the job you're looking for. So those are some of the two that I know about. But I mean, you're right about yield. Most of the bombs we have now are much smaller than those big giant tests that we did.
So I guess as a science journalist, and you've been focusing on nuclear weapons, obviously, I'm curious if you see or have any interest in like debates around AI safety. Because I think a dynamic that also coincided with the Oppenheimer release is a lot of folks in the skepticism of AI community like really tried to lay out a metaphorical and historical comparison to mm-hmm. kind of the efforts to unleash AI and the scientific questions. And once again, that gap we referenced between scientists doing research and actual heads of companies and policymakers. I'm curious how like this work you've done has like informed any thoughts you have on that topic.
Yeah, I mean, I mostly am an AI person as an interested observer. I haven't done very much reporting on it myself, but I think, I mean, yeah, you do see a lot of the same dynamics at play where, you know, some of the some of the, you know, people working on AI are raising these concerns maybe earlier than the people working on nuclear weapons did, but then also are continuing on the same trajectory of like, yeah, we have these questions and concerns, and also we're going to make it bigger and better and keep going. And it's, I think, I hope I get this quote right. I think it was Edward Teller who was the father of the hydrogen fusion bomb, the first thermonuclear bomb. You just said like he wants to know. He's working on this because it's science, and he wants to know, and he's going to pursue it regardless of the consequences, and that's his job, and what happens after that is not. And so I think that I don't know if we've learned our lessons there or not, but yeah, it's definitely interesting that, you know, that Christopher Nolan, when he was making Oppenheimer, was thinking maybe more about AI and its implications than about nuclear weapons themselves.
So here's the last actual fun question. You're a writer, obviously. Now that you bring up Edward Teller and his quotations, that crew of nuclear physicists and researchers, they were a particularly quotable bunch. They were very, 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 you know, they've got the Bhagavad Gita good to go whenever they need to. Edward Teller, could you think of a single time we've had just like that amount? I'm just thinking out loud here. I'm like, man, just quotes. Like, and obviously, like the this obviously like isn't true, but there's a world where like you're waking up in the morning, because now like once an idea is out there, there's a social construction. So I'm imagining there's like an AI person who's like spending his like bathroom time in the morning, like writing my like, I need this like epic quote to follow follow my predecessor's sense. But yeah, I was just thinking, like, man, like there's so many quote. When you said you're gonna say a quote, I'm like, man, there are like 10 different quotes you could have picked up there. Sarah, this has been, I don't want to say fun, but I think this has been really helpful, and I really enjoyed the book that your publisher sent ahead. So can you just shout out the title of the book for those who are listening on Audible, I mean, sorry, are listening via podcast and would like to learn more?
For sure. Yeah, the book is Countdown, The Blinding Future of Nuclear Weapons.
Thank you for joining me on The Realignment.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.